Do you think consciousness is just your individual identity?
Listen, dude, I asked you the question of, hey, what the fuck is this?
Turn it back on you. Okay,
no,
well, so
I
let me.
Mean, yeah. Well, what is consciousness then?
If not, what is consciousness, Dave?
We're going to figure it out.
Let's figure it out on this podcast.
Yes.
Well, okay. So to me, consciousness is not about. Not to, like identity is a part of consciousness. I'm working this out in real time, by the way. So sorry. Identity to me is a part of consciousness, but consciousness is a willing connection to the rest of the world.
Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian who survived a coma, and on this show, I talk to artists and organizers about death, art, politics, and the events that define their lives. My guest this week is Eden Robbins. Eden wrote a very impressive book that is very much in line with the themes of this show. It is a novel called Remember You Will Die, and it is told through obituaries throughout time. It's a book about an AI mother grappling with the unexpected death of her human daughter. It is, you know, as we talk about in the episode, a bit uncategorizable to its credit. And this episode was recorded almost a year ago, or I think actually a little over a year ago. So keep that in mind. We talk about the election. That's, you know, the big one, the presidential election, is the one that we're talking about. But it also means I have an update for you. Under the pseudonym Birdie Horn, which is apparently not a secret, Eden co-wrote a novel called Don't Cross Mo Ellery, which is a mystery novel about a school crossing guard. This is especially important because Eden, I know and knew first as a person who wrote about her experience becoming a school crossing guard in Chicago and what a great job it was and how it provided benefits, which led to me becoming a school crossing guard, which also led to other people becoming a school crossing guard. And so that's how we start this episode, is crossing guard talk, which I'm especially happy about. It's one of the best jobs I ever had, partially because I didn't have to work in the winter, but keep that in mind. If you like that talk, Eden has written a whole extra novel, you know, extra novel about that stuff. So keep that in mind. I'm going to post my outfit pic of working my crosswalk on Instagram. So make sure you follow the show. Go to all the links in the show notes. You'll find links to Eden, to the book. Make sure, you know, buy her book. And we also reference the guests I didn't book episode, which is a couple episodes back now, but was a year ago. That happens in this podcast. So I think that's the business stuff I need to get out of the way, except that I do not run ads on the show. The best way to support This Is Your Afterlife is on Patreon. For $5 a month, you get the premium feed with bonus episodes on the off weeks, which makes it essentially a weekly feed because you also get these episodes. And then for $15 a month, you become a posthumous producer, which means I thank you, as I'm about to do. So thank you, Fred Fidawa, Shubha Singh, G, Katie Llewellyn, and Debo. Thanks to you for listening. And now please enjoy my episode with Eden Robbins. The crossing guard thing.
Yeah.
Your influence there is very much of the type that would go in an obituary, I feel like. It's like, what pronouns do you use?
She, her.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It'd be like, she
like wrote an art. She was a crossing guard, faithful for however many years. You thought you like, didn't you feel like you would be like a lifetime crossing guard on some level?
I didn't. No? Okay. It was really kind of an of the moment thing that felt pretty magical. I knew it wasn't going to be forever, but I did love that job. And I also I do think it does fit into an obituary because it falls under a category that I love and that I thought about a lot when I was writing this, which is you never know what the thing is that is going to stick with someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go and be like, I want to make a difference. I want to do this. I want to do that. And I think people get frustrated when they approach their life's work that way because things never turn out the way you think they're going to. And the things that people remember or take from you are never the things you intend. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've had a number of situations where somebody has come up to me and been like, oh, such and such thing you said really like made me think or made me whatever. And I'm like, yes. I don't remember doing that at all.
And at my worst, the way I think of it is it's like, man, it's like a real curse to be so profound, even just off the cuff, you know?
I like that angle. I like that a lot. I just, the thing, it just delights me so much because I just,
yeah,
it just keeps you from being too up your own ass, you know, and being like, this is the important thing that I've done. Being like, you have no idea. You have no control over anything anybody thinks of you or does or the influence you have. And so I love that the crossing guard thing has just gone on and on. My only regret from that is that my supervisor came to visit me on the corner and told me she was nominating me for crossing guard of the year.
And Jeanette?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I'm like a shoo-in for this. Like, what are the other people? And I didn't get it. And I'm so mad. And I actually want to put that in my bio, like lost crossing guard of the year.
That's incredible. Okay, so I actually have a small legacy because I attended training this year. And in the part about the uniform, they mentioned, is it Karen? I think maybe her name is who does the uniform talk. And she'll be like, she'll talk about like exceptions, you know, like people who have like real bright. She's like, I have some crossing guards who have real bright shoes that they check them with me, you know,
wow.
Like that's cool, you know. and this time she said, I had a crossing guard who asked if it was okay to wear overalls in this color, in this navy blue color. And she's like, and that's fine as long as it's in these colors. And that crossing guard was me.
Overalls. So I love it.
Dude, it was a pretty sick look, I gotta say.
Well, once winter hit, it was like all bets were off. Like I had the pants and shoes. Not even the shoes, just the pants. And then it's like, well, I'm wearing like whatever sweater. Then boots. So yeah.
Fortunately, I never had to do the winter.
Well, you didn't have to do winter.
So I think that makes my memory of it like a lot.
It's a bit of a game changer. It's a bit of a different job in the winter.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. Are you okay? So why'd you move?
I've been planning.
Because I thought of you as a savior. I was like, I've been unemployed for like a year. I found this job. My Jesus Christ is leaving.
I know.
You know, I've been led astray.
No way. I've been sort of planning to move. My husband and I have been planning to move to New England for a long time, really like 4 years. And then his mom was very sick. She was in a nursing home. And so we were caring for her. And then when she died last year, that was kind of, we were like, okay, we don't have to stay here any longer.
She was in a nursing home in Chicago.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yep. And so when she died last summer, we were like, okay, now we can sort of make our plans to move on. So I kept the job longer than I had actually intended to. Because I loved it so much and it was such a great way to, you know, get insurance and meet the neighbors. And it was just like such a lovely You know, I did have to endure one shooting.
Whoa, how close?
A block away. They drove past me. Yeah, it was not great. And so I was kind of like, huh. And then I did have a nemesis who didn't like the fact that I was keeping him from turning. So he would sometimes yell at me. So there were a couple of like points of friction that I'm like, you know, not every job puts you in physical danger every day. So I don't miss that. Yeah, but there was a ton of good stuff that outweighed it.
Yeah. Well, okay. Another thing I wanted to ask you is actually, I'm sure you've had like a flurry of activity, and I don't want to assume you remember anything that you don't, but you, in the midst of posting about the book and the launch and events and stuff, I think you quoted from a review that was like, even though it's about death, it's like pretty good. And I commented and I was like, even though, I was like, what? Like, and I'm so used to the, like, I'm like, I like try to think about this podcast and like what it is and how to talk about it all the time. And to find like the perfect elevator pitch, because in my mind, it's like, everybody thinks about this stuff. I should have the biggest show on the planet. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it baffles me that actually people, of course, don't like thinking about this stuff or talking about it constantly. And so, like, what is your relationship to the idea of like, oh, my book's called Remember You Will Die, and you must have had winces in response.
Oh, yeah. Right? Oh, it kind of goes one of two ways. Either people are like, oh, or they're like, oh, sounds fun. And I'm like, it is fun. You asshole. I'm just kidding. They're all readers are all wonderful. Anyway, it's funny you bring up that review, because I actually didn't take it that way. To me, what that point was saying was that they felt that the book was lively. I don't remember the words that they used, but it was that lively and refreshing, despite the fact that it was about death. And so I think it was just the juxtaposition of the two things versus being like, yeah, it's pretty good, even though it's about death. Maybe that's what they meant, but that was definitely not my takeaway.
I think being like, but even the idea that death talks can't be lively and refreshing.
Yes.
Is still a minor bud on that tree.
Totally. And I think that people do seem to be surprised that this book isn't super dour, which is interesting to me because people love like straight dramas and tearjerkers and all this stuff. And I find them all so unrealistic because everything that I've ever experienced in life, even the most horrible things, have different sort of calibrated levels of feelings and emotions and experiences in them. I have yet to experience a single terrible event that was 100% terrible.
Right, right.
And you find even when things are terrible, I am drawn to try to find something funny or light in it. I think that's kind of a natural response. So I do think it is interesting. Yeah. I think people are so afraid of death and don't want to talk about it, which I don't really get.
I guess I'm afraid of it and I do want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Is kind of where I come from.
Yeah. It's been interesting to kind of perceive the way people do or don't want to talk about death. Like there's, you know, having just experienced a death in my mother-in-law, right as I was finishing this book, it was crazy timing. And you know, it's just interesting to see the way people react and how, you know, how some people want you to immediately feel better, how some people don't want to talk about it, how some people will try to fix it, how some people will just sit with you, you know, and ask how you're doing. But I think it's very uncomfortable. That kind of uncertainty. I've been thinking a lot about uncertainty in the past couple of days, not to get us on a tangent.
Sure. Go away. No, we can tangent. Just the past couple of days, because the book is full of uncertainty stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I've been thinking about uncertainty forever because I'm extremely bad at it. But the past couple of days in particular, as it, like the aftermath of the election.
Yeah.
Just because I see people really demanding a narrative, you know, and
yeah.
and wanting to make sense out of stuff that doesn't make a lot of sense. And it makes me really sad because I think when you what narrative is really good at is focusing your attention. But when your attention is focused, there's a lot that you miss. And I think there are some things that we need to not miss right now. And I wish that we could just sort of sit in the discomfort of not knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah. What do you think we need to not miss? What
I don't know.
Missables?
I don't know. But I think that
you're
when
just like, I know there are things. And by focusing the attention too much right now, we're missing them.
Yeah.
Does it feel like if the culture's attention is too focused, it makes it harder for the individual to open their attention up?
I do. Yeah, that's a really great way of thinking about it. Because we do, we want to be
Thank
a part
you.
Of... You're welcome. because we want to be part of something, you know? We want to make sense of things and we want to trust
yeah.
people and we want... I think there's... I hear a lot of people be like, you know, the power of story and we need to tap into the power of story and rewrite stories. And like, yeah, okay. But I also think that we should be a little hesitant to do that because of, like, I think that for me, and maybe this is how we'll segue back into the book, I'm really interested in narratives that kind of frustrate order and show the seams and the joists that a lot of times stories prevent us from seeing. And so
yes.
just going from one narrative to and jumping to another narrative, you miss how they're put together, you know? And I think that's, I don't know, I think that's kind of dangerous, no matter who's controlling
yeah.
it.
Yeah. For sure. You're in the wheelhouse. Like, we're like, you're like, we're at the same well. And you're like, I'm going to be doing kind of weirdo fiction. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to be doing this podcast.
Yeah.
And we're both like, because I read your author interview at the back because I didn't want to like repeat anything.
It's all right. I don't like anybody's going to read those.
Well, it did make me want to ask about the Jewish spaghetti Western.
Oh,
has anyone checked in on that?
Well, I've been trying to write a Western for, oh gosh, like 15 years.
Yeah.
And I keep not knowing how to do it and keep trying and failing and trying and failing. So I don't know. Eventually I will write a Jewish spaghetti Western, but the idea that I had, it kind of fell apart in my mind. So I'm not sure I'm going to do that this round. We'll see.
Yeah. But you talked about uncategorizable stuff.
Yeah.
Which feels like I don't know. I have a weird relationship to that because I'm starting to accept and embrace niche and just like, dude, your heroes are fucking like not that obscure, but like completely independent, like 80s punk bands. Like, what made you think that like you were ever destined to be like talking to Conan O'Brien on a TV? You know what I mean?
It's I do. Like... I have this conversation with myself all the time.
Okay. Yeah, how does it go?
It goes where I'm frustrated that, you know, my work doesn't reach more people or it doesn't get the kind of publicity my ego thinks it should get. And then I'm like, well, think about who are the people you admire? Who are the people whose lives you emulate? You know, who are the people that you respect? And it's always some fucking weirdos, you know, who
yeah.
didn't get the
yeah.
publicity that I thought they deserved. Always, every single time. So.
Yeah. And then you give me an example of any, especially like friends, especially being in Chicago. It's like you're given, okay, this is, I dog-eared a couple pages.
Mm-hmm.
I decided I'd bring them. I wouldn't force them, but bring them up. As they you know, if they come up in conversation. So this is the from the submission for the Voices of the 21st Century from what is it, Hester Moss?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is and it's him, right?
Well, this is in Hester Moss's cloud drive. She did
right,
not
right, right.
yeah, she did not write this.
Oh, but she Oh, shit. the neighbor wrote this. That's right. That's right. Okay. Okay. Listen.
What you didn't keep track of all of the five dozen characters?
The Always Sunny in Philadelphia Charlie meme of all the
That was me writing this book. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure, dude. I was like, yeah, I got enough of a sense from you talking in that interview in the back. It's weird because the book is so modular that the like reader's guides and the interview with you, I almost like soft focused and they felt like part of like the AI consciousness, like broadcasting something.
Interesting.
But it was, yeah, I mean, I definitely got the sense of both where it could start, because, you know, it's impressive, man. It's something so kaleidoscopic is like very impressive and intriguing in terms of like, well, this seems to have arrived. How do you make a mandala? You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. Anyway, so it's so whoever the fuck is talking here is saying there are so many of us out here almost making it, almost remembered, feeling the sweet breath of success on our cheeks and then slipping, stumbling, getting lost, or just plain losing the scent for no discernible reason. I'm proud of my almost. Almosts have kept me alive, and I don't mean just breathing. They may have kept me from being remembered, but it's this life that matters, not whatever is in the next. Mm-hmm. And that reminded me of Chicago. I was like, that feels like a thesis statement for some of us in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And also, you know, and then the last part as well is just very much like this show in terms of I at this point will have just released an episode of me reading and responding to the years of cold email pitches I've gotten from people, which, you know, I love to be reached out to.
Sure. Yeah.
But the pitches for guests on a show called This Is Your Afterlife are universally people I'm not interested in.
Wow, really?
To. Yeah, because it's all fucking Heaven Is For Real Colton Burpo shit.
Oh,
dude.
No.
It's
why?
Yeah, it's all like mediums. It's super woo-woo, right? And I'm like, I'd like to talk about the abolition of the prison industrial complex. You know what I mean? And it's like, people are like, wait, why is that on the Afterlife show? And I like, I have the Charlie Day like strings in my head of why that is. Yeah. But it's because talking about death is talking about life, and it should be so painfully obvious that that's the case in my mind.
I agree. Well, and I think that stuff, the woo-woo stuff, is kind of the only way that people can touch this idea of death. Like, they can only deal with it if it's got some kind of mystical element. Like, it's not earthly. It's not, it's, you know, like, just part of life. It's got to be this heaven medium kind of thing. And look, I love a woo-woo, you know, don't get me wrong. Probably, maybe not a heaven thing so much, but.
I would have said that I love a woo-woo, but.
Are you sick of it by now?
Less and less do I love a woo-woo. I love a fucking, like, story of anarchists sabotaging an electricity grid is what I love. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I think there are, you know, it's important. It's important to me to, when there's something that's enraging me, to not then resolve that by going to the opposite of it. You know, it's again this like sort of sitting in uncertainty. Like, there's, yes, I'm all about the sabotaging the electrical grid, and you know, I love a tarot reading and all the stuff in between.
Of course. But a tarot reading is interesting not because of some magic in the cards, because what you're doing with them is interpreting your fucking life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think for the almost thing, let me posit something to you.
Yes.
Because I think about that a lot. And I've actually been thinking that we sort of strive for success, right? Like, this, to have the success that we think we are owed, that our ego is telling us that we deserve. Like, what we do is great. Obviously, it should be getting recognition as things that are good all should. However, I feel like success is inherently destabilizing for your psyche. I think it distances you from yourself a little bit. And whereas I think that failures and attempts can actually teach you a lot about yourself, really be grounding. They can be disappointing, but there's nothing like dissociative about failing.
You think even so, success is a very like nebulous concept here, especially because it's self-defined.
You're talking about the success of like,
I mean, like success, fame, or something. Like, is there even just a small level of success that you think is dissociating?
Yeah, I think so. And by success, I mean like this idea of you make a thing, you get recognition for it, you are rewarded for it, in whatever small way. I think that kind of success feels good a little bit, but mostly it feels weird. And it doesn't teach you anything about yourself. And it is, I think, a little bit, even the small ones, a little bit dissociative. And the failures are instructive and enriching. I hate to say this because I really would, you know, just love endless, bottomless success. But I have my experiences, you kind of have to work to feel like yourself.
Well, it's interesting because, it could be get very meta very quickly. But it's like, to have real failure, you have to. You can't just be like, okay, well, failure is the thing, so I'm going to shoot for failure. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to be shooting for some type of success to experience that failure, don't you? Or am I?
I don't know. I mean, I think that if we're talking about making something and receiving some sort of recognition for it, which is the kind of success.
So it's recognition. Okay, so the completion of a project is not like a type of success that would fit into the dissociative type.
Not in a person, like if it's a completion of a project, a personal success to me is different. Like had a goal and you succeeded in that goal. I mean, sort of external success. And I do feel like any kind of external success, you know, we may sort of trick ourselves, but I think it inherently, if we're being very honest, feels kind of bad in the long term. I think so. I'm going to throw it out there. I'm going to postulate this. And then I think failure, although it's disappointing, can be very instructive. And again, I don't like it. And I will continue to seek success. But yeah. I can tell you, it feels a little hollow.
Well, then how do you not let that change something about what you're seeking?
I mean, I think that the things that I'm seeking are inherent in the project itself and that are personal. And that, you know, the external success, I don't know. I live in this society. I'm not sure how I could not seek that, you know. And if you you create things, you want to connect with people in some way. Otherwise, you know, you would just have a personal journal and you would lock up that journal and never show anybody. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a delicate balance between connecting with people and whatever else success is that is not that connection.
We're talking about narrative, and the big thing that I think about, quick tangent, you know Hanif Abdurraqib?
Mm-hmm.
I watched a talk by him recently, and he referenced that Johnny Cash only wrote songs about three things, and they were love, God, and murder. And he was like,
I love Hanif. I mean, what an amazing analysis.
Literally,
he does.
Said things in this talk that I had not considered before. It was wild. I was like, this is what a genius is. It's like, yeah. But so his were, he was like, okay, what are my three themes? And I forget exactly what they are. I think they were like grief, home, place, and I don't know, something else. But so then I did this exercise for myself. And one of the ones I think is one of my three is transformation, I think. And if I could tell someone what this podcast is, I would be like, oh, well, it's about death in the sense that, you know, all sorts of moments in our lives are deaths, and we're going through processes of transformation all the time. And so that is the thinking behind the question, what's your coma, which is a moment of transformation for you where before you can identify very clearly, oh, I'm one version of myself, and after, you're another. And this is where narrative comes in, because with my coma, I'm sober now, and got sober like as a result of that. But in early sobriety, I was like doing like really cruel, like lashing out, sort of just constantly on edge sort of things. And that does not fit with the narrative of like the before me and the after me. You know what I mean?
I so do,
like
yeah.
however jagged a narrative this is, any moment of transformation that fits these sort of parameters.
Yeah. Well, luckily I can think of one that relates to writing this book. which was I think I've always sort of worried about being too weird, and felt like I can easily toe the line. You know, I can appear less weird than I am. I can fit in. I can be an introvert in or an extrovert clothing. You know, I can do whatever it is that needs to be done to kind of mold myself to whatever the situation is that I'm in. And I think that's a good skill to have, but it can be a damaging one. And I don't think I really realized that until fairly recently, which was that during 2020, I had quit my job to write a book. And then like I literally quit in March of 2020, which is just what? And then like just couldn't write. And the harder I tried to fit a normal narrative onto the page, the less able I was to do it. And it's, like you said, when you said that you sort of gravitate toward the weirdos, I found myself reading all of these books of fragmented narratives, and I found them so satisfying. Just really weird stuff that did not fit a traditional narrative. And I was like, what if I just, like, don't worry about what it is that I'm making, whether it's going to be palatable, whether I'm going to be comprehensible, and just kind of do the thing that I need to do and fuck it, you know? And so I really creatively kind of said, fuck it. And which was weird because I was in the middle of a 2-book deal and I did have to write something or else give some money back.
Yeah,
not a lot of money, but like more than I, as an unemployed person, would have liked to give back.
Yeah.
And so I was sort of under scrutiny a little bit, or in some capacity. So saying fuck it did come with real consequences. But I think the thing was, I just decided that I wasn't going to be imprisoned by those consequences. I'm sort of thinking aloud as I'm saying this, but like I'm always wanting to please people, you know, and I'm wanting them to think that I'm okay and that I'm not, you know, that I'm palatable, that everything is, you know, I can be me, but maybe like watch out for being too much me. And in this context, I was like, God damn it, I'm just gonna do the weird thing. And it was hard. It was the hardest thing. Writing this book was one of the hardest creative projects I've ever had to do. But it also really was the thing that my brain wanted to make. And it was in the way that my brain wanted to make it. And that was a real lesson to me, because no matter what I do, there's always people being like, I don't get it. You know?
Yeah.
But there weren't, weren't any more people saying that than normal for this one. And there were people that were like, wow, this really speaks to me. And so I was like, okay, I've learned a lesson that, you know, it had made my need to be palatable conscious in a way that it hadn't been before. And because it was conscious, I now have the choice to not do it.
Well, and so then as a result of that, is that a finding your form, finding your voice sort of? So for me, the coma became material to do on stage and quickly became, you know, stories as opposed to just jokes, and then a one-man show. And then I did the one-man show and I was like, oh, this feels great. So I'm like, okay, I want to keep making things in this form. So was it that kind of thing where now you're like, I write fragmented narratives, or is there some more abstract, but like how tangible is the change? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
How like concrete is it?
It's pretty abstract because it's really just about listening to and trusting my inclinations. But again, this is your jagged story and the perils of narrative thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be, I'm feeling the urge to like wrap this up real neatly and be like, and now I always listen to myself and I always do the weird thing. No, I don't. But I do think that it shined a light on stuff that had just been habitual. And when you shine a light on things that are habitual, you see how the parts move, and then you can see those parts moving in the moment. This is what I'm saying about like the thing that I think is fragmented to me is this idea of like taking an extra beat to not gloss over, to not make the easy narrative, whether that's in my own life or in the work that I make.
Yeah.
So it's less about form and more about a philosophy, let's call it.
When it comes to your own personality, are there things that you, if you're sanding something down to present to someone, where are the first corners you're taking the sandpaper where you're like, okay, is it just like, is it introvert? Is it like, you're like pumping up the energy that you've got? Or for me, it would be like some sort of like literally like having to modulate my voice to make it a little like quieter or less demonstrative. You know what I mean? And it's like unfortunate that it overlaps with typical white guy stuff to have like a guy who's like telling you, you know, being very like too intense in a way. But like, well, yeah, what are those for you?
Well, here, let me give you an example of a story. So briefly, many years ago, I was going to graduate school for international affairs at George Washington University.
Okay.
That was a mistake.
So this is all your fault.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So I got there because I was like, oh, I was really interested in maybe doing some kind of like journalism and activism and, you know, something. But I didn't do enough research or something, because I got into one of the classes that everybody had to take as part of the master's program. And it wasn't that it was hard or difficult to understand, but I sat in that classroom and I was like, is this really the shit we're teaching people? This is ridiculous. And everybody in the class was, a lot of them were majors, international affairs majors in undergrad. And so they were used to it and they just thought of it as fact. And this is just like sort of the structure of like, I think it was just like a basic international affairs 101 kind of class. And they were just like, this is the narrative. This is how countries relate to each other. This is how politics works. And I'm not saying that I was correct here, but as an outsider, I was looking in and we were having some discussion about something that didn't make any fucking sense. And I raised my hand and I was like, did it occur to anybody that like maybe things don't actually work this way? And
what was the response?
The response was complete silence and then immediate change of subject.
That's like, actually like such a weirdly truthful response that they gave you.
Well, but I don't even know. It was just like it what it felt like to me at the time was that I didn't exist. That that I had said something and I wasn't even ashamed of like, oh, was that the wrong thing to say? Maybe it was. Maybe it was so stupid. But the way it felt was just like, oh my God, I just don't even exist here.
Yeah.
And so I eventually dropped out of this program because it was a nightmare for obvious reasons. And I think the reason I bring this up as an example is that I think a lot of times I fear that kind of feeling of non-existence, of like trying to connect, saying something that's on my mind or that expresses the way that I think and having the response be anyway, you know, and like just a complete. So I think how that manifests for me is less of a like, you know, I need to add extra energy, although there is a little bit of that too, and more of a fear of being inscrutable to other people.
Yeah. Does it come from, I mean, the thing I'm associating it with is like, I'll talk to my partner who is weird. And I would guess a similar way, where we'll be like cooking and she's just like, can you believe that mushrooms exist? And I'm like, you know, and my like initial like dickhead response is like, what? Yes, let's keep cooking, you know? But then I like get past that and I'm like, actually, no. Like, what? You know, like it's like on a deep, deep level, if you're willing to, if everyone were constantly willing to rethink everything, then people interacting in that way would be natural.
Yeah.
But for some understandable reasons and for some really unfortunate reasons, that doesn't happen. Do you think it is like, do you consider that sort of erasure to be like, I associate it with like a what is it? Like a carrot, not a type of person exactly, but a predisposition, basically. Or a disposition that people have that lends them to those types of responses? Or does it feel like way more particular to just like specific experiences that you've had?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously, like you have to calibrate yourself to other people. That's part of what connection is, you know, you can't, you know, we are all individuals. And then part of the joy of connection is the ways in which we meet. We're like human Venn diagrams, right? And and so it's not like I'm looking to ask everybody all the time, isn't it weird that mushrooms exist? Although it is weird.
Right.
I mean, they're just like, what are they even? They help trees talk to each other? It's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Some of them are like some of the oldest things in the world. Anyway, whatever. You know, I don't need to go off on a tangent like that all the time. But I do have people in my life who part of the meeting halfway is that when I say something, you know, or want to talk about something, they are also willing to talk about it and we can, you know, connect in that way and then move on. And I do definitely think that I have a tendency to self-censor more than I need to, that's a decision that I make that I don't have to. And so part of this bit of transformation that I had was that I don't need to keep myself on such a tight leash.
And has that played out? Like, do you feel like you self-censor less away from the art?
No, but I but I do notice when I'm doing it more.
Yeah.
And whatever. I mean, it's just interesting. It's just interesting to me to be like, wow, this is like such old behavior. You know, it's just interesting how it comes up. And I do think that like personal changes sort of happen in a spiral, you know, rather than like a line where you end up in the same place that you started, but you're a little bit above where you started.
What do you hope happens when you die?
When I die, personally?
Well, yeah, I guess either generally or personally. Yeah.
Okay. So we briefly talked about mushroom suits, which seems like it's a common topic on this podcast.
Well, let's see. Common topics on the podcast have been mushroom suits, Corpus Mundi, the plant yourself into an egg that turns into a tree. This is more when we talk about like funeral planning and people's like, you know, plans for their bodies. There was a, I guess people can, you can have your ashes pressed into a record. You can have them pressed into a stone so someone can wear it as a ring.
Okay. So here's that's like way too haunted for me.
And we're not like I don't even mean to limit it necessarily to your body.
Oh, no. But this has to do with my body or our bodies when we die, because these are how we interact with the world and that house our consciousness, whatever it may be. I wrote about this a little bit in the book, but I've been sort of fascinated with this idea that consciousness is something earthbound, that it's not unique to humans, but it is an element of living, of being alive, and that different organisms have it in different capacities or in different configurations, perhaps, and that this is the configuration that we have it in. And so if that's the case, then when we die, in the same way that our cells and atoms, you know, can become part of something else, then maybe our consciousness can too. And so this is why I like the idea of a mushroom suit, or something where like I can be pretty sure that my body is going to decompose and become a part of something else. Because if that's the case, then whatever pieces of my consciousness exist can continue to live on in some capacity. It's not going to be me, but I like the idea of being regenerated into sort of like a larger capital L life.
Yeah.
And you know, so I won't be myself. I'll be dispersed. I'll be, you know, part of a cockroach or a stone. That seems like the nature of life is that being regenerated as something else.
Would you say that it's with this in mind that you theorized consciousness could be an emergent phenomenon that exists along a spectrum, one that is chemical and not physical, not mystical or religious? And that this could mean that bits of consciousness might survive after death, be, quote, scattered to the wind during decomposition, and if properly gathered, potentially recomposed?
I don't know about potentially recomposed.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe.
This is your Elon Musk character, right? Or like
this is the
Bezosian.
No, he wouldn't be that smart. This was the.
This is the computer scientist.
The computer scientist, yeah. Well, and I took this, or I first learned about this. So I didn't come up with this. I'm not smart enough to come up with something like that. But I had read a wonderful essay by David Graeber. Who is sadly dead and had died in the past couple of years. He had written some like amazing things. What a brilliant thinker he was. So the article is called What's the Point If We Can't Have Fun? And it's just, I read it over and over and over again. It's so wonderful. And there's a bit in there about consciousness and you know, what it is and where it comes from. And then I just sort of took that and extrapolated it. But I think there have been other people who have made had this thought before too. But it is one that I like to play with.
I only have a few dog ears and we so far have gone through them sequentially.
Was that one already dog eared?
That was, yeah.
Oh
yeah.
My
that was
God.
A thing that I, well,
great
because
minds.
We think it, we, oh my God, I hated the way I did that. Because I was about to say, like, on this podcast.
Well, you were going to be the royal
this,
we.
I was going, yeah, ugh. I did not like that. So on the podcast, we've talked about, I just did it again.
You just did it again, that's right.
But the specific we's, myself and my guests have
and
talked
another person.
About conscious, because the thing that fucks me up about death is the loss of individual consciousness. So that's like where I'm driving to. But I wonder, and you even like some character basically says it in the book that like, okay, well, that's just reincarnation, is, you know, and to me, reincarnation is unsatisfying because if my own consciousness doesn't survive in a piece of that house, then like it might as well just be a completely new person.
Yeah. You don't get to be you.
Yeah. So where does your, I mean, it sounds like as you're describing it, you've even said like, it won't be me anymore. What's your, then what is the purpose of calling it consciousness?
Do you think consciousness is just your individual identity?
Listen, dude, I asked you the question of, hey, what the fuck is this?
Turn it back on you. Okay, let me.
But truly without like judgment, I mean, yeah, it's a great. Well, what is consciousness then?
If not, what is consciousness, Dave?
We're going to figure it out.
Let's figure it out on this podcast.
Yes.
Well, okay. So to me, consciousness is not about, not like identity is a part of consciousness. I'm working this out in real time, by the way. So sorry. Identity to me is a part of consciousness, but consciousness is a willing connection to the rest of the world. Mm. And if that, it's something more, it's like being a part of something, having, I keep thinking about connection on this podcast, so I don't know, it's on my brain, maybe it's because of everything else this week, connection, disconnection, but consciousness is an interaction, a relationship, and a willingness to be a part of life. And so I think that we will be finding in the future, and we already know, finding in the future that there are other organisms that have a kind of consciousness. Even if you talk about trees, that there are trees that they'll reorient their resources to other trees that need it more, you know, in certain forests. There is sort of an alarm that goes off if one tree starts to be attacked by insects, and that it can warn other trees. Yeah. And so these are very like literal elements of consciousness potentially. But I think we are limited by our own narrative of human consciousness and what we can do. And so we think that's the only way to be. And I think that there are other approaches if we can reorient that definition a little bit.
Yeah. But if your consciousness gets redispersed,
you still get to be a part of things. I mean, in my ideal death scenario, yes, I don't get to be me. Yeah. Anymore. But like how poignant is that? You know, you have this little window that you get to be you. You have this like moment of organization of self, and then you're sort of dispersed to the wind, and then you get to be something else. Without that memory, you don't have the memory, but you do get to be a part.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is so much like, you know, letting go in the book is a literal, you know, phrase that keeps appearing. And so I was curious, you're really, you know, as I'm reading, I'm like, okay, well, what's her relationship to the ability to let go? And you know, how tightly you're clinging to.
So tight. Just the most. I mean, again, these are the jagged edges of narrative. This is like my ideal self. You know, this is
of course.
I want to be. I want to be able to let go. But I think it's naturally, it's human to hold on to, you know. That's just kind of how we are.
There's a lot of suicide in the book.
Yeah.
Just like not holding on. It's like, and I don't know. I actually did not plan to ask you this, but have been thinking about this a little bit recently. It's so tough to separate online dialogue from wondering. I imagine you're in a like, well, maybe not. I'm 40, like in like a sort of geriatric millennial.
Oh yeah, space. I mean, I'm almost 46.
Okay, so you remember when stuff that happened online wasn't necessarily reflected in life, or if you mentioned something that someone posted, it almost felt embarrassing, like you were like spying on them or something.
Right.
Like that. Now it's easy to mistake online dialogue for just what's happening. Like people will reference things as if you're all aware, as if the algorithm we're all relying on has just naturally known and fed you those things.
Mm.
And the thing that I am seeing in my algorithm, and I say all that to say, I don't know if this is a popular opinion or not, but there seems to be a thread of online, especially left, especially like woke, and I don't even say that pejoratively or complimentarily, people who talk about redefining a relationship to suicide. That where some aspects of it have been really helpful for me. So to hear, I'm like, you know, when we talk about death, I kind of want people to always say like someone died rather than passed or something.
Yeah,
I want to be like, you know, but then also, so my instinct is to go, okay, someone committed suicide, they killed themselves. But I find died by suicide a really helpful reframing of that. However, when I hear people say that it is a denial of someone's will to that suicide is someone's choice, that it is like, you know, you can support them, you can be there for them, you can like be I present other options, but it just, it gets so dangerously close to just like encouraging suicide in my mind. And maybe these people would say that it's something totally different.
But if you're interpreting it that way, you're not the only one who's interpreting it that way, you know?
True. But I mean, I guess, so I say all that to say, and this is the one part where I'll apologize for like thinking as I talk. Because man, no. I'm just saying so far, I'm aware how long my questions to you have been. But what's your relationship to suicide?
Oh, God.
Is suicide bad? No, but really is like, I don't know. It just fucks. Because I want people to have autonomy. I want people to have choice. And I can, once it's happened, I can recognize that like this person made this choice, not retroactively shame them, like their memory. In my mind, maybe it's just a programmed American Western thing. I'm like, you stay alive. Like, you avoid suicide at all costs.
Yeah.
And I say this as someone who's had the thoughts. So I don't know. Where's the question in there? The question is about, like, seeing so much of it in the book. I'm wondering what your relationship to these ideas is.
Well, okay, so let's first of all start you mentioned the died by suicide. And there's a lot of like, I went through a lot of like the journalistic best practices when talking about suicide in this book, because there are best practices and I don't think you have the final version of the book. You have the arc, right? That in the final version there's a content warning for suicide because there have been, it has been found that, at least in journalism, that if you have a quick message about how suicide is preventable and there are people you can talk to, that can actually do a lot to prevent people from being triggered into acting when they see it in print. And one of the other journalistic best practices is to say things like died by suicide and to not give extensive details. So anyway, that's just an aside that I did go through and do the best that I could, given the fact that it's also a novel, to sort of adhere to those. Personally, like, I don't know. I'm not saying this is right, but I find it shocking. I find it horrible and shocking. I have lost some people in my life to suicide. And I don't know. I think maybe the part of the reason I have it in the book is just to try and like, work through my own shock of it, of that choice. I mean, it is a choice, obviously, because literally
it happens. Yeah.
That is a thing that a person chose to do. But no, I can't get behind the rationalizing of it. Like obviously you don't shame someone after their death.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can't, I can't be here rationalizing, being like, well, it's, and what am I going to do? It's just their choice. Like, no, no, that's not just a choice. Like, you know, what am I going to have for dinner?
Yeah.
I can't, if that is the argument that people are making, like, I don't know, online is sick and twisted.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there, when you've been shocked by it, I mean, have you had moments of suicidal ideation?
Not really, to be honest. I'm lucky in that way. And so maybe it's because it's hard for me to relate to, but also, you know, the times that I have been grieving people who have died by suicide, it becomes very personal, but then it's still shocking to me. And it's not like, why did you do this? You know, how dare you? You know, I hear people be like, it's so selfish or whatever. And I'm like, this is so irrelevant. Like, it's so irrelevant and weird and mean. And it's not ever something I've contemplated seriously, though. So, you know, take my opinion for what you will, with that in mind.
Well, you know what I appreciate, though, is like, in terms of sort of like saying someone died as opposed to pass, there is something so matter of fact about presenting this stuff in obituaries that it's like, even when you're saying like at their own hand or by suicide, it's literally in print. It's not like, it's not spoken, you know, it's not delivered with a hem and a ha or a hesitation. It's just the one word follows the other word. And there's something really comforting about that.
I agree. Because it is ultimately a journalistic form, right? Like these are all fiction, but the form is nonfiction. And in addition to the fact that obituaries do this nice job of like taking the gross, stinky mud of your life and like turning it into a sculpture that makes some kind of sense. Mm-hmm. It's also like this very soothing kind of factual setup, you know, like there's a structure to it. There is the kinds of things that you include and the kinds of things that you don't include. There's a lot of wiggle room in obituaries of like the tone that you know, there are funny ones. There are, I mean, I read so many about like people who hated the people who died and, you know, and like, you know, or they can be more factual or they can be about famous people, whatever. There's a lot of wiggle room, but there is something kind of like almost ritualistic about it, you know, like almost like a.
Yeah.
I was about to say a prayer. I don't know if I agree with that, but like there is something kind of like, this is how we do this. This is how we talk about death. This is not the place for feelings, even though the feelings are implied. There's a precision to the language.
That reminds me of what in the interview you say was your favorite one to write, which is the sort of what's the other word for sci-fi that's not sci-fi, that's
speculative?
About speculative,
yeah,
obituary you write for Anne Frank, from the perspective of this high school student, and specifically the notes, like it's a draft of this obituary with notes returned from the, I imagine, like
the principal.
Yeah. Oh, the principal. Okay.
So it's actually, like, it's a teacher. She's a teacher writing the obituary, but is being given notes by the principal.
Oh, wow. I thought this was a student.
Some people have thought that. Yeah, no, because she's talking about when she was a student, but, doesn't really matter,
Okay, that adds, that does up the stakes of the notes a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, just this principle being like, you think we're going to print this, like you can't say this. But I mean, I can't be the only one who's like connecting to the writer to be like, fuck you, like let her say this. You know what I mean? Like, and wanting the fun of that, wanting the more personal version of that, because I did, when I first moved to Cleveland a few months ago, we stayed with my, we're not married, but effectively mother-in-law and her husband, and they read the paper a lot. So I did start like reading a couple obituaries, and they were way more boring than I wanted them to be.
It depends on the source. Some of them are really entertaining, and then other ones are pretty dry.
Yeah. I like the idea of like regionally, just like, yeah, Cleveland's just got a bunch of.
Well, this is something I learned is that like, yeah, certain like the Telegraph in the UK is like known for its very snarky obits. And then there's like a couple other papers that are known for like very vibrant obits of just regular people, you know. So it does kind of depend, if not regionally, then by from like periodical to periodical.
This must be part of every book talk, but what have you identified as either tonally or content wise things that you'd like in your own obituary?
Yeah, I keep meaning to write my own obituary because I would like to teach a class on it and on writing your own obituaries. And I like haven't been able to do it. I don't know. Like I've been really dragging my feet.
I mean, understand.
but it's like if I'm like, oh, this is going to be really good. It's going to be very cathartic, you know, which I really believe, but I can't like convince myself to do it. So I've been having a real mental block thinking about what I would want in my own obituary. Which is weird because like, I don't know that day to day I'm really afraid of death or being dead or whatever. But I don't know. I don't know what I would want to say. Like I was going to say that maybe it's not up to the person who's dying to write their own obituary, but that's not true because there are people who do that.
Yeah, but there are things that you could want to be
remembered for.
The twist, the typical "this is your afterlife" question that I'm twisting here is funeral planning, where it's just like anything you know about how you would or wouldn't want to be remembered. It doesn't even have to form a coherent picture.
I think I would want to be remembered as somebody who was curious and always interested in what was going on. And that I didn't live a fearful life, you know, even when things were scary, and that I cared for people in my community. And that I made people laugh. That's probably as good as I got right now.
This podcast grows out of one of those one-man shows that was set in an afterlife. And I offered the premise in this afterlife that everyone gets to choose one single memory to relive particularly vividly whenever they want, as many times as they want, not at the expense of other memories, but it is a separate privileged thing that you get to pop into and out of. And if you had to choose just one.
Oh my God.
Well, and I'll vamp a little bit by saying, don't feel the need to summarize your life. Don't feel the need to make it particularly anything, particularly funny, particularly poignant. Whatever's coming up is the right answer.
All right. Well, then I'm just going to go with the thing that came up.
Great.
Which was the very first time. So I love to travel. And the very first time I left the country was for a study abroad program that I did in Tanzania, which was incredible. And there was this moment, and like I can kind of place it in time, but it was just, I have never felt so free and open and just like excited about life in general, and like, but not in a like, ooh, like tense kind of way, but just like, oh my God, just being like extremely open. And I was riding in the back of a Land Rover with the top down across the savannah as the sun was setting. And it was just like, I mean, you know, if you think about it, it's really just, I'm in a car during a sunset. right? But there was something about that moment that was, it feels almost like the crux of my life in a way. Like there was something very important that happened in that moment that I can't, I still, this was 25 years ago. I couldn't put my finger on it, but to feel that way again in that place, in that moment with those people, would be
Were the people who were you driving?
They were other college students with me that, like, it was also just like this group of people. We had an incredible rapport almost immediately, you know, and it's just so special when that happens. Like you meet strangers and you're like, boom, like we've clicked. I'm still friends with a lot of them. And so to be there with these people, you know, all kind of, I think, probably feeling about the same thing. Yeah, was a really spectacular moment that I would love to relive in vivid detail.
How do you remember the colors of the sunset?
I remember it being very pink.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Clouds?
Not very. I mean, like in the grand scheme of sunsets, like not a super spectacular one. Like I have seen some spectacular sunsets. Yeah. This one was just like a really, like a watercolor kind of, not too many clouds, pink on the horizon, blue further up, the, you know, kind of a yellowish savanna grass, you know.
Were there any animals?
Not at that time. It was just pretty flat.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what had you done earlier in the day? Like, where were you coming from and going to? Do you remember?
I think, you know, we did a lot of like, it was both an ecology and kind of an anthropology program. So we would like hang out with different groups of people and sort of learn skills that they wanted to teach us, or we would go and do little sciencey animal things. So I'm sure we had some kind of curriculum-based activity that was vaguely, you know, educational during the day, and then we were driving back to camp that night. So I don't remember exactly what the thing was we did that day.
Yeah. So you were at a camp, was where
the camp? It was like a not like a summer camp, but like tents.
Yeah.
Tents set up. Yeah, we were staying in a camp. Yeah.
Okay. For how long?
In that, so this, the whole program was the course of a semester, so I think 3.5 months. This particular spot was, you know, maybe 4 or 5 days, something like that.
Okay. How big is the program? Is everyone fitting into the back of this one?
No, there were several Land Rovers. Yeah.
Okay.
There were maybe about 20 of us, 22, something like that.
Okay.
And this was, oh, right. This was around Halloween, I think, because somehow we got pumpkins and we carved jack-o'-lanterns. I don't remember if it was the same day.
Okay.
And I think that remains the best jack-o'-lantern I've ever carved in my life, because I'd carved a little circle, taken it out, put it in wrong side in so it looked like a pig nose.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took two pumpkin stems and made tusks, and it was a warthog.
That's great.
And I was like, this is pretty good.
Did you have the idea before that, or was it just in the carving?
It was just, you know, kind of like a Michelangelo sort of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just, you know, I just bring out what's in the marble.
Exactly. Yeah. And the marble is pumpkin flesh.
Pumpkin. Yep.
Yeah. If I push you one more time, is there any, can you put words to what the came together in that moment?
The feeling?
Yeah.
So I was 19, almost 20. And this was, again, the first time I had left the country, the first like really big adventurous thing I had ever done. And it felt like this kind of soul enlargening moment. You know, do you ever feel like your insides are pressing against your outsides in a way, sort of like pushing you, making you bigger from the inside?
Yes.
Is that the spaciousness, maybe that is the kind of word that I would use. I felt this like almost infinite spaciousness inside me.
Is it scary at all?
That moment? No. I think I used to be a lot braver, and those kinds of feelings made me feel awesome. And now when I feel them, I'm always a little bit scared.
Because I had one, and it was like at the top of a little mountain and on a little island off of Ireland. And it was just this feeling of like you know, I have like damage from growing up evangelical. So it's like this idea, you know, certainly plays into the desire to keep going after death and the idea of like a personal consciousness, higher power is still compelling, you know? And so just the idea of like, and to me, and that is that spaciousness, but it felt anxious in this way of like, I felt like an absence. A little bit. You know what I mean? Which is like,
it's like almost like a selflessness. Like you don't really feel like a self anymore.
No, I felt like a self that was alone.
Oh, interesting.
But what's wild is it was like stormy and it was gray, but it was like beautiful and it was epic. And my mind wants to like twist and create, like, I'm very like compelled by certain like mystical Christian thinking, you know, the idea of like God as an absence or something like that, you know, is like compelling to me. But then I'm like, but I don't know, man, in that moment, I was pretty just like felt alone.
Did you feel like the small, like the with the vastness of the universe, like did you feel small?
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. Yeah.
Because I feel like those are the feeling small and the feeling expansive. Like there's a, you go around far enough and it's the other one.
Yes. Yes.
The horseshoe theory. This is also interesting to me to hear that you grew up evangelical, because I grew up Jewish and there's no afterlife. So like, I've never really.
Right.
Like, whatever. That's just not a thing that I ever contemplated, really.
I know. And I want to think that I'm like, you know, a unique individual arriving at genuine beliefs, and then you look back and you're like, it was just kind of carved in, and you're not gonna completely shake this out, you know.
This is all part of your unique individuality. Like these are all the pieces that made you who you are.
That's true. Well, I feel a lot better as a result of this. So thank you.
Oh, really?
You actually have like there are several things that you've said that I'll need to re-listen to, because there are like, we're just like on the same page, but you have like the words that you've been using to describe some of these things really illuminate some things. And it's very nice. It's really fucking wild. And it's really nice to talk to someone about this stuff who's been thinking about this stuff, and not for the purpose of offering life coaching lessons. You know what I mean?
No. Oh my God, I'd be the worst life coach. But I'm really glad to hear that. You know, I sometimes think that like, you just need someone to say something in a slightly different way that you've already been thinking about, but it's like kind of joggles you just a little bit. And if that is the case, then it just goes to show you literally never know when something's going to hit someone right.
I mean, hopefully, I think I am, at least for myself, in terms of success, the internally guided success of this show is that I am carving out space for these conversations to happen. And I'm like, I don't know if it's going to happen, but I do have these times every week or a couple weeks or so where if something's going to happen, chances are decent it happens in that moment, in that period of time, you know?
Yeah. Well, the internal compass of like the stuff, the status for me, like internal success is really just satisfaction, right? So like, that's different. That's different than like the external stuff.
That's the show. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Eden, for coming on. Please go to all the links, every single link in the episode description, and learn more about Eden's amazing, impressive, cool, thoughtful work. Thank you to Matt Sage for the show's art, and This Is Your Afterlife house band Lake Mary for the music. Visit patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife to support the show and get the premium feed. Follow This Is Your Afterlife on Instagram. Go to thisisyourafterlife.com for more info, and email thoughts, questions, and preemptive eulogies to thisisyourafterlifepodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, remember, you are a mist.